Well met, and welcome to episode 89, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 30th, 2014. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our two-month-long discussion of Julius Caesar with a review of some of the video productions available, plus a live theater, though non-Caesarian, review. Now, the first film that I could find was from 1950, adapted and directed by David Bradley. And no, that's not the same David Bradley that played Filch in the Harry Potter films. From the first frame, this doesn't feel like your average everyday Shakespeare. A moaning soothsayer's voice becomes audible, slowly rising with every statement of his Ides of March warning, his face slowly growing larger against the black background until the warning is almost a howl. The musical sting feels more like Hammer horror than masterpiece theater. In fact, between the use of some of the silent film elements, wooden exclamatory physical gesturing, and focusing the viewer's attention by use of masking or blocking out the edges of the screen, those musical cues and intense close-ups, the vibe is decidedly Night of the Living Dead, which I guess is sort of groundbreaking since this is nearly 20 years before Romero's zombie classic. The passion of the filmmaking techniques cannot, however, make up for some of the amateurish acting. When Cassius recounts his past with Caesar, the camera slowly zooms in until his face, eyebrows to chin, fills the screen while the actor stares directly at the camera. Now, this would be tough to do if we were watching Branagh, and this actor is no Branagh. Calpurnia fares no better, waking from her dream with a scream straight out of another horror film. Bradley is his own Brutus, and I'll say that he needed to find another actor. The one actor that escapes, mostly unscathed, is Charlton Heston as Antony. His funeral oration is pretty well done for being so early in his career. This was, at age 27, one of his first credited films, and that speech is probably the most effective of the film, though the assassination sequence isn't bad. It's certainly better than the final battle scenes, which use tight shots to make up for an obvious lack of extras. As I said before, the oration is good, and the building of suspense to the assassination, as shot from above, showing the conspirators all moving slowly, tightening their circle around Caesar, is effective. And the attack on Cinna the poet is quite scary in its sudden brutality. I did like the way Bradley cut the film into two parts, the death of Caesar and the revenge of Caesar. But the weakness of the actors, or maybe it was the direction of the actors, takes away from any positive aspects of the film. Bradley didn't do many movies, and he was 30 when he made this one. As I did a little research on the film, I found that he had been a student at Northwestern University with Charlton Heston, and this 16mm feature was enough to get Bradley a directorial intern job at MGM. It's not a great film, sitting really on the border between mediocre and good. And except for Heston, who shows promise even here, and whose voice is just plain awesome. I mean, he was going to be Moses, for Christ's sakes, in just half a dozen years. There's not much to recommend this. There are definitely better Caesars out there. Now, 3 years later, in 1953, a larger production with a better-built cast was released, directed by Joseph Mankiewicz, who had already won an Oscar for All About Eve, and who would later direct Guys and Dolls, Suddenly Last Summer, Cleopatra, and Sleuth. Here, it's Oscar winner Marlon Brando as Antony, James Mason as Brutus, John Gielgud as Cassius, Louis Calhern as Caesar, Greer Garson as Calpurnia, and Deborah Carr as Portia. Brando would be nominated for this too, as was the film itself for Best Picture, winning only the award for Best Art Direction. It's a solid production. Even with some sharp editing of the text, done uncredited by Mankiewicz himself, it runs a full 2 hours. Despite the film feeling a little dated, there are some good things here. In the opening scene, Flavius is immediately arrested upon leaving Morellus. When Caesar commands Antony to touch Calpurnia to remove her barren curse, Garson's look as Caesar's wife is an interesting mix of sadness and hurt. There is no voluntary wound speech from Portia, nor is there the Portia-Lucius scene just before the assassination. When the other conspirators attack Caesar, Brutus backs away, horrified, and it's only when Caesar himself stumbles towards Brutus that Brutus participates. Maybe part of the datedness that I find in the film comes from the performance by Brando. The king of method acting does a very good job here, giving a measured, more typical performance of the era. But that disconnect took me out of the picture. Not that the performance is bad, it's just not what I think of as Brando. There's a story that Brando had Gielgud record the funeral oration speech and that Brando used it as a model. Now, it may have been a bad thing that I heard about that story because that's all I could hear in that speech. At the end of Act 4, Scene 1, when Antony and Octavius discuss the future, there's a curious shot of Antony turning a bust of Caesar towards himself, almost as if measuring himself against the old leader. It's a nice touch. As is Brutus seeming to want to attack Caesar's ghost, a feeling of desperation. But the film just sort of ends, with Antony giving his speech over Brutus's body in Octavius's tent, with no sense of the moral ambiguity of the speech. If you're looking for a solid presentation of the play, you could do a lot worse than this. If you're looking for something deeper and more thoughtful, you might want to watch it for comparison. It is available on DVD and for both purchase and rental streaming on Amazon.com. Now in 1955, for the U.S. television series Studio One in Hollywood, Julius Caesar was presented as a one-hour cut, adapted by Leo Penn, father of Sean Penn, and directed by Daniel Petrie, who would later direct A Raisin in the Sun and Sybil, among others. Theodore Bacall played Caesar, and he's pretty much the only face I recognized. He and the other actors, too, from Philip Bornhoff as Brutus to Alfred Ryder as Mark Antony and Michael Strong as Casca, put in solid performances. The production is noteworthy primarily because of its length and the extreme nature of the cuts. Portia? Gone, except for Brutus kissing a sleeping one when she should have been discussing the voluntary wound in her thigh. Artemidorus? Gone. Octavius? Gone, so there's no marking for death the opponents of the triumvirate. The battlefield confusion of Act 5? Gone. We go from the ghost of Caesar to Brutus finding Cassius dead. The major plot points are there, in that the dead do die in all the right places, but the depth of the play just doesn't come across. And while some of that is because of the old-school grainy black-and-white video and wooden soundstage, not to mention the commercial breaks by Westinghouse, most of it is because of the cuts. So, though this is available via Hulu, there's really not too much of a reason to check it out. Watch it only if you're a completist. From the 1955 television version, we jump forward 15 years for the Stuart Burge-directed 1970 film adaptation. Only this kind of feels a little like Back to the Future. We've got the same Antony as our first film, 20 years earlier, and the Casca from the Brando version has become the Caesar in this one. In 1970, this Robert Furnival-scripted new widescreen color version of the play was released, with a more mature Charlton Heston reprising the Antony role and Gielgud taking over the title role. In the role of Brutus, we have the respected American actor Jason Robards, with Diana Rigg as Portia, Robert Vaughn as Casca. Burge fills his film with some fine touches. A prologue set on an old battlefield showing us the toil of war. A wonderfully vain Caesar who at one point even preens before a mirror, but whose sense of foreboding is prophetic. There's an almost knowing glance between him and Cassius when the soothsayer delivers his warning. If Caesar is vain, then Richard Johnson's Cassius is disgruntled and bitter, while Vaughn's Casca looks nothing more than a decade-early forerunner of Belushi's John Blutarski at the Delta House's toga party. But he's deeper than that. When the conspirators debate the location of the rising sun, he points his sword at the rising sun, S-O-N, Brutus. And Heston's intervening two decades has given him the physical and presentational gravitas to make this Antony great. Heston just simply kicks ass in the role. All of this sounds great, doesn't it? Like it's one for the ages. There's only one problem, and his name is Brutus. Robards is the black hole at the center of this film. Wooden, stiff, dull. The portrayal is so boring, I'm falling asleep just thinking about it. It almost makes every one of his scenes unwatchable. I mean, even Diana Rigg, pretty much at the peak of her heat as an actress, can barely make you want to pay attention to Portia's scene with Brutus. And she gets neither the voluntary wound speech or the semi-comic scene with Lucius at the end of Act 2. Burge does some interesting things with perspective. We see Calpurnia's dream, we see much of the assassination from Caesar's point of view, and the camera from within the crowd shows the terrifying actions of the mob after Antony's masterful swaying of the citizenry during his funeral oration, though we don't get the Sin of the Poet sequence. It's a solid production in which no character comes off particularly positive or likable. After the funeral, Antony and Octavius, played by a very young Richard Chamberlain, come off as spoiled, privileged frat boys, getting massages while discussing the division of the empire and kicking back before battles. Except for Robards, this is a very good Caesar. Just be prepared to be dumbfounded by his performance. It's available on DVD and for rental and purchase streaming on Amazon. For the premiere season of the BBC Collected Works series of productions, Herbert Wise directed Julius Caesar in July of 1978 for broadcast early the next year in both the UK and the US. He had originally wanted to set the play in Shakespeare's contemporary Elizabethan England, but due to the series' constraints for realism, I've got the air quotes working there, he was overruled. Now, the reason why I use the air quotes just now is that, like all of the other plays in the series, save As You Like It, Julius Caesar was shot on a soundstage, so realism is a pretty relative term here. And while Wise may have been overruled on the setting, many of the rest of his choices pull us out of the realistic telling of the tale anyway. Heavy use of voiceovers, as well as tight, tight close-ups. The first time we see this is with Cassius at the end of Act 1, Scene 2, after he's spoken with Brutus at the Lupercalia. The tight view of his eyes and his voice over non-moving lips gives the actor David Collings an almost delusional feel. We next see the voiceover in Brutus's soliloquy in Act 2, Scene 1, and here Richard Pascoe, who was the Jaques in As You Like It, uses the opportunity to play with the rhythms and timing of the lines, turning the usual, "I know no personal cause to spurn at him, but for the general, he would be crowned." 2, "I know no personal cause to spurn at him, but for the general, he would be crowned." And this is a good example of Pascoe's exemplary and thoughtful work in the production. From his burst of exasperation with the conspirators later in that scene, to his hard work on the crowd in his funeral oration, to his almost violent quarrel with Cassius in Act 4, Pascoe's Brutus is an active force. Since the BBC series put an emphasis on using the whole text, we finally get the voluntary wound speech, as well as the semi-comic interplay with Lucius at the end of Act 2. Needless to say, Virginia McKenna uses these to deepen the portrayal of the loyal wife. The assassination is well done, with single stabbings taking their toll, then Caesar stumbling to Brutus, hugging him for support before Brutus stabs him as well, and then from that point on, it's really butchery when Caesar's down. Antony, as Keith Mitchell plays him, is an aging and hard-drinking party boy. His sorrowful speech to Caesar's corpse in front of the conspirators is done aloud, interesting as the 1970 version has the speech as a voiceover. His later soliloquy over the corpse is done as a voiceover, however, punctuated by his audible screams of "Caesar" and "Havoc!" It's surprisingly effective. But it's in the funeral oration where Mitchell really comes alive. Now, it's not as good as Heston's in the 1970 version. And honestly, I thought there were moments when Mitchell was doing a Heston imitation, but it is a very strong piece of work. The production is good, the performances are strong, and the direction fine. You can almost hear the butt coming, right? Well, the pacing drags in the last two acts, where in some of the other versions, the play seems to double in speed. And that hurts this production. Still, Pascoe is great as Brutus, and as he is, to a certain extent, the audience surrogate in the play, at least early on, the slow later pace is a small price to pay to avoid Robards' stone-like performance in the 1970 version. This one's on DVD, on some library streaming sources, and on YouTube as well as available for rental and purchase streaming on Amazon. The last, most recent video version I found was done 2 years ago, a whopping 34 years after the BBC version. This one was directed on both the stage and film by Gregory Doran for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now, full disclosure, I haven't been a huge fan of the RSC-filmed productions. They've ranged from the sterile and cold, like their Midsummer Night's Dream, to the overtly reverent, as in their recent broadcasts to movie houses, of both parts of Henry IV with Antony Scher as Falstaff. But this Julius Caesar is different. Doran sets his production in a current-day African nation, where coup d'états are commonplace and soothsayers might well be witch doctors, and cell phones can capture ad hoc executions. The Afro-British accents and rhythms perfectly propel the meter, and they sound completely natural. The play opens on a stage with a band, celebrations, dancing, and chanting. The tribunes break it up, Caesar and his train appear, and then suddenly we're in a hallway offstage with Cassius and Brutus. The rest of the play is shot on location, returning to the stage only at the end when Antony and Octavius are speechifying over Brutus's corpse. The acting is superb. Patterson Joseph's Brutus is a revelation. Neither the idealistic dolt nor the envy-driven follower, his is a naive, well-meaning man who knows deep in his heart that this is all wrong. But the thrilling combination of power and making political change sweeps him up, growing his confidence so that before this all crashes around him, he'll be as cocky as Caesar. Cassius, as portrayed by Cyril Nourrit, is the smartest guy in the room, but with neither Brutus's nor Antony's ability to sway the masses. He can convince Brutus to join, but only under the guise of multiple people, and once Brutus is there, Cassius's power is diminished. Here, Cassius is driven by hurt pride as Geoffrey Kissoon's Caesar snubs him on multiple occasions. Hurt, too, is Adjoa Ando as Portia, who just freaking nails this performance. Director Doran is masterful with the details. Casca's description of the Caesarian non-crowning is done in a restroom, his sarcastic throwaway remarks punctuated by him taking a piss. Cassius's solo discussion of Brutus at the end of the same scene is performed in the restroom mirror as if rehearsing his arguments. Then when he moves on to the more typical soliloquy, he turns to the camera. That camera, so smooth and stable in the first half of the film, switches to a handheld one jostled by the crowd during the funeral orations, and to a grainy cell phone for the executions that follow. The whole damned thing is masterful. So unless you're a traditionalist and a stickler for historical casting and costuming accuracy, this is the film to search out. It's available only for sale on DVD, but I've got a link to it from my Amazon favorites box in the left-hand navigational menu on the blog. It's worth the search and the purchase. Though it's not technically Julius Caesar, another film of note is the 2008 Richard Linklater film, Me and Morrison Wells. Starring Zac Efron and Claire Danes, it is centered on the week leading up to the 1937 premiere of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater production of Julius Caesar in New York City. Christian McKay has a charismatic turn as the young Welles, and the film does show some of the genius behind his staging, including the use of modern dress and striking sets and lighting. This one I saw and rather enjoyed when it opened, and it has stuck with me. So if memory serves, this is worth a visual visit, even beyond its Caesar-centric aspects. Last Thursday, my wife Lisa and I hit the road to the University of California at Santa Barbara to catch the touring Shakespeare's Globe presentation of King Lear as its tour of the U.S. is winding down. To call the production lean and mean would be insulting and would give the false impression that it seemed to lack something. This stripped-down production wants for very, very little. Let me set the scene. University lecture hall on the stage, an Elizabethan-style booth stage, no curtain, props and costuming easily visible resting on the set. Within about 10 minutes to showtime, the actors begin to mill about on stage and then into the crowd, chatting up some of the audience. I didn't get a chance to talk to any, so I can't say for certain, but I would guess that they spoke as people, as actors, as themselves, as opposed to the characters. One actor had an accordion, which she begins to play. Other actors come back to the stage. A song. A dance. The lights go down, and an actor welcomes us and talks of how they will attempt to recreate the Globe experience. The house lights will be raised, somewhat, during the show to replicate the open air of the outdoor theater, and we're off. With an 8-person cast. Yeah, you heard that right. 8 actors. 5 actors take on multiple speaking roles, while all but Lear also take on non-speaking spearholder roles. Some play musical instruments, all with seamless transitions. Sometimes it's merely a walk downstage, put on a cap or a jacket, and returning upstage as the new character. Well, all seamless except for one. The actor playing both Edmund and Oswald had a second act sequence where he had to bounce back and forth between the parts, played for comic relief. Much has been made of the actor playing Lear, Joseph Marcel, being the butler in the early 90s Will Smith sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. But as I never watched the show, it wasn't shocking to me at all to see him as an aging king descending into madness. He was very good, showing both the mental and physical deterioration. Each time he talked of a broken heart, it was like he was struck with a mild heart attack, with the cumulative effect by the end of the play. The other members of the cast were just as good. Daniel Beery was wonderfully blustery as the malevolent bastard Edmund. Bill Nash's Kent was the stillness at the eye of the hurricane as he is needed to be. And Bethan Coulinane played both ousted daughter Cordelia and the fool in a funny and heartbreaking combination. Now, I've often thought that Lear is Shakespeare's ultimate triumph as a playwright, that this is his masterpiece on the page. But because of all that is in the play, the characters, the parallels, the subplots, madness and cruelty, there's simply no way to have a great, let alone a perfect, production on stage. And I'm not going to say this is a perfect production, nor is it transcendent. But this touring Lear, with its small cast, economically trimmed text, and mercurial direction by Bill Buckhurst, flirts with greatness, coming the closest to a full realization of the play that I have ever seen. There's only a handful of dates left on the U.S. tour, but if you are in Northern California or Seattle, try to catch this before it is lost to sight and sound forever, living only in our memory. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries these last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including Caesar, Wells, 1938, and more on the radio, Julius Caesar sources, history, the run-up to Rome and Julius Caesar, short and awkward, real history, the players, magic in the scansion, Philippi, Julius Caesar, history versus drama, weak conditions and voluntary wounds, the body of Julius Caesar, what body? The comedy of Julius Caesar. Wait, what? Oh, you get the picture. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussion of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 30th, 2014. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.